it was the first time I had ever heard that you could get a degree in winemaking. And I said, that's for me.
Robert Parker has established himself as a critical reviewer with an acute palate. I'm just wondering where that female is.
The wine industry is addicting. It draws you back.
To me, the romance is in the glass, and it's when you're done with the bottle.
And we would spend our summer afternoons swimming in the irrigation pond for 3 to 4 hours a day.
Even though it's tough work, nobody said it would ever be easy. You know, we do it as a family.
In the final analysis, somebody's going to pop the cork, and they're either going to like the wine or they're not going to like the wine.
Since I made Cabernet all my life at Behringer, I buy Cabernet, so should never let a winemaker own their own winery.
We were either going back to Switzerland to go to hotel school, or we were going to come to California. We had to get closer to the vineyard thing.
It's like when you go to one of those winemaker dinners where the winemaker doesn't quite get that not everyone is telling jokes about the acid level in the wine all night.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to podcast number 94. This week we feature our second interview with Charlie Smith of Smith Madrone Winery on Spring Mountain.
Followers of Life Between the Vines may remember our very first conversation with Charlie Smith of Smith Madrone Vineyards and Winery. It was podcast number 2 in July of 2008. We were able to get Charlie back on the mic in June of this year, because there really is nothing like hearing Charlie tell stories from Spring Mountain. We are back once again with Charlie Smith of Smith Madrone up on Spring Mountain. How are you doing today, Charlie?
Just fine, thank you.
It's a stunning day up here. Have you guys had some sun up here, or has it just been pretty much enveloped in fog?
No, it's actually been cool. I mean, it's a beautiful day, but it's not warm.
Yeah.
And the entire spring has been cool, I think.
Yeah.
Been an extremely early spring, but it's still been cool.
Actually, you know, I don't know if you ever got a chance to listen to the podcast, but for 2 years, I use a series of quotes in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And you gave me a great quote last time about the idea of you'd made X amount of vintages. That's not very many. I want to make more.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
People
yeah.
commented on that quite yeah. often. They yeah. really liked it.
Yeah, interesting.
Well,
yeah.
it puts things in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, I was thinking about what I wanted to talk to you about, you know, since we talked a few years ago. I guess one question I've always wondered about is, why did you and Stuart choose Spring Mountain? What was the appeal here, especially considering the work you had to do?
Actually, that's pretty easy. For starters, the place was for sale, which is an important component. But our nearest neighbor toward the valley floor is Stony Hill, which was an extremely important winery at that time. They pretty much proved that quality Burgundian style, or at least Burgundian level quality-wise, wines could be grown here on Spring Mountain. They're our nearest neighbor toward the valley floor, and they had a lot to do with us buying this particular piece of property. But it's also true, coming off of Spring Mountain Road, that there was at least two very large vineyards, one of which was selling a lot of its grapes to BV, and that wine was being, this is Cabernet I'm talking about now, not Chardonnay,
mm-hmm.
and this Cabernet was being turned into the George de la Tour Private Reserve at BV, which I think is one of the most important wines in the history of the county. Some of those wines that were being made by Andrei Chelichev basically formed the foundation of the reputation of the Napa Valley. Without Stony Hill and without BV, it would have taken longer for us to become who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So it made the choice of this particular property relatively easy. Plus, of course, Hillside Vineyards have a reputation worldwide for producing quality fruit. And then there's one other thing. It was cheaper. Hillside Vineyard without vineyards on it is considerably cheaper than Valley Floor Vineyards with Valley Floor property, I should say, with vineyard already on it. So this place in some ways is a triumph of, how should we put this, elbow grease over capitalization. We only had a certain amount of money. We had to do the best we could with the money we had. That made moving into the hills easy.
So it just worked into your plan.
Absolutely.
But yeah. it still had to be a pretty big expense to clear all the trees. And how long did that take? Those are two questions.
Didn't take as long as you might think. For starters, great big D8 Caterpillar is perfectly capable of pushing over a fully mature Douglas fir in about 15 or 20 minutes.
Wow.
So then something that could in theory have been actually quite expensive actually turned out to be far less expensive than you might imagine, because we traded tractor time for the actual cost of the trees. So when the trees were harvested, what am I trying to say here? We swapped lumber for tractor time, and it was kind of a push. We actually got the place cleared for almost nothing.
How long did that take you to do that?
About a year. Bought the property in early 1971, and by the end of the summer of the following year, the first 20 acres around the winery here were planted, and a little bit more was actually cleared off and being ready to plant.
Well, you guys worked fast.
Yeah, there was a lot of time and effort put into the place, yes.
Yeah, I don't imagine there's much of a life outside of the vineyard at that time.
No.
Yeah.
No. Not for the next 10 years either. Really, in all honesty.
Well, yeah. That's kind of what the business is.
Yeah.
And your first vintage again was?
The first year we made wine was 1977. The grapes were planted in 1972. And it takes you roughly 4 to 5 years to get grapes. We might have been able to make a very small amount of wine in 1976, but honestly, we didn't have a roof on the winery yet, and so it was easy. What small amount of grapes that we actually had, it was easy enough to sell them off and sort of going full bore in 1977.
Yeah, that's still a pretty good gap of time between your investment and when it started to...
I didn't want to say pay off, but...
No, there's no question about it. It's the long, hard way to do things.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
But again, you guys were pioneers up here. You're pioneers in the valley because of the time frame that you came in.
We're, I would say, sort of early in the first real wave that came in. I mean, there had been dribs and drabs of people. Small wineries had started up. Stramsburg had started up 5 or 6 years before we had... Oh, actually, I think Stramsburg probably started nearly 10 years before us, probably in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. Stony Hill had started up in the 50s. Across the way was Souverain, which was owned by a guy named Lee Stewart, so on and so forth. But still, you're right, in the entire county, I don't think there was more than about 24 or 25 wineries when we started. We were probably the second winery on Spring Mountain proper, right? Yeah, it was. We were early, let's put it this way. And in terms of timing, in the sense, in terms of buying our property and clearing everything off, we were absolutely just dumb lucky with timing. I mean, it was a really, really good time to do what we did, and we just fell into it, really.
Yeah, yeah, I would say all the way around, in a million ways, you really got lucky time-wise.
Absolutely, no question.
Now, this is going to be an ignorant question, so... No. I'm just thinking about the idea of being the early 70s and what it was like up here. Were there a lot of people living on the mountain at that time at all?
No, not at all.
So what were the roads like at that time?
Well, I mean, Spring Mountain Road was fine. It wasn't any worse or any better than it is now. You know, it goes all the way down over into Sonoma County. It was a much smaller valley in those days. There weren't nearly as many wineries. The town itself was, I think, a sort of charming agricultural backwater. There were very few decent places to eat. There weren't very many places to buy clothes. About all you could buy in St. Helena were Levi's. There was, I don't know, two or three auto parts stores, a couple of tractor places, more than our share of bars. There were a surprising number of bars. It was just really, really small town, sort of, as I said, kind of a forgotten part of the San Francisco Bay Area, you know. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, it was lovely. It really was. And there was a very, very good feeling in the valley as a whole. Nobody saw you as a rival, a new winery, that is to say. It wasn't seen as a winery. It was seen as something that could help increase the appetite for wine in the country as a whole. New wineries were seen as good things, not as a potential rival. And there was definitely a sense that we were all sort of in a pioneering endeavor. It was fun.
Well, and you all had a lot at risk, too. I mean, considering there was no real reputation yet, considering post-prohibition.
You know, honestly, everybody knew we made good wine.
Yeah, good.
I don't think there was any doubt that the quality of the wine that was being turned out here in those days was really first class. I don't think anybody thought of us as being potentially on the world stage. Nobody envisioned the Napa Valley of today back then. You just couldn't see that far ahead of time. All anybody was interested was making very good quality wine, and if it helped the valley as a whole, that was widely considered a good thing, you know. As I said, there was just a much more fellow feeling back then, and a sense that we were all sort of in it together.
So since that time, have you added any acreage at all?
Not really. We've been at about the same acreage level for a long time. We probably haven't had any vineyards since about 1981 or two, I would think. We've been at about 40 acres, between 35 and 40, depending on the health of the vineyard and what's been replanted and replanted and so on. But no, honestly, we haven't changed size in at least 30 years, as far as I can recall.
And everything you do is estate.
Yeah, we don't buy any grapes.
Yeah.
And we sell, I don't think we've sold any grapes in 4 or 5. Well, I remember we sold a little bit before the recession. Grape prices were going completely through the roof back then. And somebody came along and decided that they just couldn't live without a couple of tons of Spring Mountain Cabernet and wanted to give us a really large chunk of money for it. So we thought about it for a while and said, okay.
Why not?
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Good cash flow.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, as of right now, to the best of my knowledge,
sure,
you make the Riesling, you make Chardonnay, and you make a Cabernet.
Right.
And you're also making a high-end Cabernet now.
Yeah, we do. We make what's called Cook's Lot Reserve, which is a very low production, expensive, a wine that we cull through all of the barrels that we have to come up with a small amount of what we consider the very, very best wine that we can conceivably do in a given year. That is to say, something that really makes us exceedingly happy, right? And we started that in 2007. It's actually a current release. It is expensive. It's $200 a bottle, which, of course, is a great deal more than what we call the estate, which is only $45 a bottle. You know, it's our entry into the high end of things. And honestly, we think the wine's wonderful and worth it.
Oddly enough, I'm glad to see you do that, although my letter is still sitting on my countertop, and it'll probably remain there for a long time.
It's the low end of the high end in the Napa Valley. You know, I mean, there are wines moving in the $150 range all the way up to $750, or if not more. It's certainly possible to buy a bottle of Napa Valley Cabernet on the open market in New York for $1,300 or $1,400. In my judgment, makes our $200 look like a pretty damn good deal. But, of course, we think our $45 bottle of State Cabernet is also a damn good deal.
Actually, that's something I would wholeheartedly agree with, because I still have plenty of them sitting in my chiller, and only now have I been able to get my hands on those 2007s.
Oh, yeah.
Which you only released them 6 months, or was it longer?
Oh, it's probably been in the, yeah, it's probably been on the market for the last 6 or 7 months.
They're a little hard to find, though, at the 2007.
We don't produce that much of anything to begin right with, so, I mean, you're from Wisconsin?
Right.
You're not going to see a lot of that on the shelves of Wisconsin, that's for sure, right.
Well, you know, it's a good, from what I can see, and I don't know about the retail end of it, but it seems to sell pretty well because it's consistent at a few of the regular places I go. Obviously, there's a demand for it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, we're a good value.
Yeah, I would agree.
In fact, from my point of view, we're an extremely good value. You know, we're in a situation here where neither my brother or myself really is willing to go on the road full time. If you're going to sell any wine in the $75, $85, $90 a bottle range, some principal of the winery really has to get out there and push in order to keep sales perking at that level. And honestly, we didn't get into the wine business to do that. Right. Rightly or wrongly, we got into the wine business to grow grapes and make wine, you know. God in heaven, sometimes selling it is more than, you know, you can deal with. We think growing grapes and making wine is our forte. Selling it perhaps isn't.
Sure.
Yeah.
Then again, too, you've been around long enough. I personally believe that the name is going to stand out. If you've got a history of making great wine, it's going to follow you, and you're going to create a fan base. I mean, that seems to be how it works.
I think it's helpful, very helpful, that we've been around for a long time. Over the years, we've developed, I think, a reputation for being good, solid value for the money, and there's no question that it helps sell wine.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're going to keep this short. I think you got a lot going on today. Actually, I thought you guys were going to be bottling today. I guess not, or?
We're not bottling until the 7th.
Okay.
Which is actually a Friday.
That's a ways away yet.
Which, if we were actually bottling, it would be so chaotic here, I couldn't possibly have agreed to this interview.
Well, that's why I was kind of surprised about it, let alone the noise involved with bottling.
Oh, yeah,
so,
no, yeah. Right. No,
okay,
no.
Well, I'm glad you weren't bottling.
We're moving fast and at full bore on bottling day.
I want to talk about the 2007 again. Did you sit on that a little bit longer from what I remember than what you normally
no,
do? Or no.
No, not really. No. No, it's just come along in due course. We're always a couple of years behind. It's something that's worked out for us very well. We're still making wine in what I would consider the old-fashioned way. You know, the alcohols, while they're higher than they used to be, are still, you know, hovering right around 14, say between 13.9 and 14.2. the wines are built to last. They're built for the long run. They've got some tannins, some acid. They're not high alcohol wines that are meant to drink and drink now. On the other hand, we want people to drink them reasonably. You know, we want people to be able to enjoy them, right? Even young. It's just one of the realities of the marketplace. And when you sell wine, if you're going to be successful at it, you've got to have a wine that's appealing to people who want to serve it by the glass. Restaurants need to buy it, and so on and so forth. You know, there's just no getting around that. So for us, holding the wine in the bottle for a couple of years pays off. And that's why even the reserve, I think, has come around a little bit in a way that's been very useful. Both the estate and the reserve at 2007, sure, were a couple of years, but the wines have definitely benefited from being in the bottle for an extra couple of years before we release them.
Yeah, I cracked the 2007 once I got a hand on it, probably about 2 months ago. It's really, really
good. It's
lovely,
isn't it? Yeah, it really is a nice wine. Yeah. You know, just between us, I have actually tasted the estate against wines that were similarly built but cost literally four times the money.
Right.
We do better than just compete on an equal basis. I mean, the wines, I think it's a lovely wine. We're very proud of it. I don't think there's any question that 2007 was a sterling year. It really was special. And interestingly enough, it seems to be one of those years that actually earned its reputation honestly, in the sense that the reason 2007 got a good reputation is because the wines, people tasted them and said, hey, these are good.
Right.
As opposed to somebody announcing before the vintage has even started that it's going to be the year of the century, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. It's kind of irritating for a wine fan to be able to see that.
Absolutely.
You want to have it once it's been in the bottle. You want to know what's going on with it.
No question.
I think you've done a great job, but I'm going to say something just for myself as a compliment.
Sure.
The fact that you've told the line with your prices, where a lot of people might be tempted to go ahead and kick it up a bit, you've kept it pretty consistent for a heck of a long time.
No, that's one of the reasons why we really would like to keep the estate at a reasonable price. And that's one of the reasons why we've come out with the reserve, which is admittedly considerably a higher price. And we can do that, keep the estate at a reasonable price if we've got this other thing that we're selling that's admittedly not quite that reasonable.
I guess it depends on what you consider reasonable and what's inside your wallet.
Absolutely,
at a given time.
Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah. Well, you already answered one of my questions regarding alcohol, which was good because that's also something I felt it's all about balance for me when I drink a wine. You get something that's a little bit too hot. I've never had that experience with your wines.
No, you know, not too long ago, we had a tasting of some very, very expensive wines, super expensive wines, way more than we are. Mm. And a couple of those wines were in the 15.5% to 16% range. One of them was 15.7%, the other one was 16%. That's not even as high as it gets. Just parenthetically, we had another wine, not in part of this particular tasting that we were involved in, that actually said 16.6% on the bottle. That's really, really high.
Yeah.
And just for the benefit of the listeners, the way a wine presents itself on the palate is hugely influenced by this kind of alcohol. One of the wines that were in this tasting, the 16.1% wine, I thought was extremely well made. Honestly, it was great. Lovely seems like an inappropriate adjective for a wine that's this powerful, but aromatically, it was really quite spectacular. On the palate, as well made as it was, I thought the wine was just too weighty. It's just tremendously heavy. You know, it's like lead glass, leaded glass. You know, you can feel how heavy it is just by picking it up. As well made as I thought this wine was, I thought it was just too damn heavy to really be able to enjoy a full glass of it. On the other hand, there's no denying that it was well made. I don't want to be seen to be dumping on wines just automatically because they're high in alcohol. I could forgive anybody for really liking this wine. I think that's probably true that there are poorly made high alcohol wines just as there are poorly made low alcohol wines. Our choice should be between the good ones at either end of the scale.
Right. That's the difference. I mean, there's so many choices out there. You know, it's having the confidence to buy something and buy it again. When you buy something you like, stay with it.
One last thing on this alcohol business, which of course is incredibly important and is the subject of conversation among the winemaking fraternity all over the world. One of the stars of the wine library of the cellar right at the moment is the 95 Cabernet. It's just terrific. It's what an older Cabernet is supposed to be like. And it's only 13.1% alcohol.
Nice.
We haven't made a wine that low in 15 years.
Well, there's a handful of winemakers out there that carry that torch. They want to keep the alcohol level low because of the balance.
You're going to have an awful hard time competing if you're going to keep your alcohols in the 13.1 to 13.3 range.
Yeah.
You just really are. That wine, that 95, if it was out right now, we were put out that very same wine now, I'm not sure people would give it any particular amount of respect.
Do you think people really pay that much attention to the alcohol when they see it? Is that how you're
referring to it? No, I don't think so. But I mean, I think that the fact that it's lighter weight,
got it,
that it's got a little bit more acidity, that the whole structure of the wine's a little different. If you put a wine like that in a tasting with wines that are 15 and 16%, it'll just disappear.
Yeah, yeah. I see your point. That makes good sense.
Yeah.
I can't argue with that. Charlie, for our listeners who would like to learn about Smith Madrone up here on Spring Mountain, on the web, how would they find out about you?
www.smithmadrone.com.
And I know that you're by appointment up here, which is pretty important. If they want to come see you, they should give a call.
Yes, it's important to call us. We're a small outfit. The guys who do the work are the guys who show people around. There's no tasting room as such. So anybody who comes to visit is going to be shown around by myself or my brother. So we do need people to phone ahead, even if it is part of the conditions of our permit to operate that we ask for appointments.
Oh, it's respectful. It's polite.
Yeah.
Not only that, it's important, too, for our listeners to know when they come here, this is a working winery. I mean, you can hear everything's going on behind me. This is a place nobody's stopping because we're sitting here.
There's a tank being cleaned as we speak.
That's what it's all about. You're in the winery. You're right in the cellar there tasting. Is there a phone number you'd like to pass along at all?
Sure. It's 707-963-2283. That's the office phone in the winery. And if nobody picks up the phone, leave your message and we'll get back to you.
And they will too. Charlie, once again, it's been great seeing you. Thanks very much for this time.
Ray, it's been a pleasure.
Learn more about Smith Madrone by visiting smithmadrone.com.
Thanks for listening, and watch for our next program featuring Tom Thornton and Brenda Mixon of The Grade Cellars. Cheers.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Our intern is Steve Lance. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2013.